Welcome to Politics is Local, a special election time program series of KHOI Community Radio. We bring you an exploration of local candidates, local constituents, and local issues. Issues explored in depth as you might not hear on other media outlets. I'm your host for today, Greta Anderson. Today's topic is the environment, and here in Iowa, that means water issues, agriculture issues, and more water issues. Today's guests include Irv Kloss, longtime Ames resident and retired ISU professor, best known for his leadership in the creation of Ada Hayden Reservoir and Heritage Park. We also hear from Mark Edwards, a Boone resident, retired after decades as trails coordinator and administrator at the Iowa DNR. And we have Ralph Rosenberg, Ames resident and former state legislator, who is currently director of the Iowa Environmental Council. All three of these men count the environment and its ability to sustain human and other life as the defining issue of the upcoming election. Of course, the major political event of this week was the first of three presidential debates between Democratic candidate Hillary Rodham Clinton and Republican candidate Donald J. Trump. These two squared off on Monday, and there was not much talk of the environment except for this one exchange, which came early on during a discussion of jobs and the economy.
They've looked at my plans and they've said, okay, if we can do this, and I intend to get it done, we will have 10 million more new jobs because we will be making investments where we can grow the economy. Take clean energy. Some country is going to be the clean energy superpower of the 21st century. Donald thinks that climate change is a hoax perpetrated by the Chinese. I think it's real.
I do not say that.
And I think it's important that we grip this and deal with it, both at home and abroad. And here's what we can do. We can deploy a half a billion more solar panels. We can have enough clean energy to power every home. We can build a new modern electric grid. That's a lot of jobs. That's a lot of new economic activity. So I've tried to be very specific about what we can and should do, and I am determined that we're going to get the economy really moving again, building on the progress we've made over the last 8 years, but never going back to what got us in trouble in the first place.
Mr. Trump.
She talks about solar panels. We invested in a solar company, our country. That was a disaster. They lost plenty of money on that one. Now, look, I'm a great believer in all forms of energy. But we're putting a lot of people out of work. Our energy policies are a disaster. Our country is losing so much in terms of energy, in terms of paying off our debt. You can't do what you're looking to do with $20 trillion in debt.
That was Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump on Monday night. And that was all the attention the environment got in the 1.5 hour debate. Let's listen again.
Donald thinks that climate change is a hoax perpetrated by the Chinese. I think it's real.
I do not say that.
And I think it's important that we grip this and deal with it.
Of course, a multitude of fact checkers were at the ready on Monday night. Trump referred to the scandal surrounding Solyndra, a company manufacturing parts for solar panels, which defaulted on a $535 million loan, in part because the industry was changing so rapidly that the part they were manufacturing became obsolete. But the federal loan agency that is assisting companies on alternative energy projects is, according to NPR, operating in the black with only a 2% default rate. Later in the show, we'll have more to say about the fossil fuel economy that Trump claims is lagging when we discuss the local and global issue of the Bakken pipeline. But did he or didn't he call climate change a hoax? Back in November of 2012, he tweeted that, quote, "The concept of global warming was created by and for the Chinese in order to make U.S. manufacturing non-competitive," unquote. His team did not delete this tweet, and he has said the equivalent on multiple occasions on the campaign trail. Let's listen.
I think that there'll be little change here. It'll go up. It'll get a little cooler. It'll get a little warmer like it always has for millions of years. It'll get cooler. It'll get warmer. It's called weather. I do believe in clean. And I've received, a lot of people don't know this, I've received many environmental awards, many, many environmental awards for the work I do. And I believe strongly in clean water and clean air. But I don't believe that what they say, I think it's a big scam for a lot of people to make a lot of money.
I'm not a believer in global warming. I'm not a believer in man-made global warming. It could be warming, and it's going to start to cool at some point. And, you know, in the 1920s, people talked about global cooling. I don't know if you know that or not. They thought the Earth was cooling. Now it's global warming. And actually, we've had times where the weather wasn't working out, so they change it to extreme weather, and they have all different names, you know, so that it fits the bill. But the problem we have, if you look at, you know, our energy costs and all of the things that we're doing to solve a problem that I don't think in any major fashion exists. I mean, Obama thinks it's the number one problem of the world today, and I think it's very low on the list. So I am not a believer, and I will, unless somebody can prove something to me, I believe there's weather, I believe there's change, and I believe it goes up and it goes down and it goes up again, and it changes depending on years. And
by the way, it's supposed to be 70 degrees today. It's freezing here. Speaking of global warming, we need some global warming. It's freezing. Man. In fact, this is a record cold spell on the whole big section of the United States. It's not just Rochester. The whole big section is like record cold. And I keep hearing about global warming. Now they'll say, he doesn't understand. This is a worldwide problem. Oh, no, I don't understand. Let's do IQ tests. So, these people.
That Donald Trump medley includes snippets from a conversation with Bill O'Reilly and at a town hall in Rochester, New York. But perhaps most telling is this Q&A from a rally in Hilton Head, South Carolina.
Go ahead. Go ahead, darling.
Hi, Mr. Trump.
Hi.
I'm Megan. I'm a volunteer with the League of Conservation Voters. And
good.
I'm here to ask you what your plan is to reduce pollution that is driving climate change and endangering public health.
That's an interesting question. Let me ask you a question. Okay. So we have global. Let me ask you this. Okay, take it easy, fellas. How many people here believe in global warming? Do you believe in global warming? Who believes in global warming? Who believes in global warming? Who believes in global warming? Raise your hand. Wow. Not much, huh? Do you have your hand up? Little? No? No. Nobody? One person?
Well, sir, that's...
Well, it's a very interesting... You believe, right? You believe? Okay.
People here don't believe.
Okay, we're going to do two more questions. Two more questions. Let's go.
Interestingly enough, an article from the Atlantic Monthly this past June noted that Donald Trump has changed position on global warming. 7 years ago, in the autumn of 2009, as the U.S. headed to the annual climate summit in Copenhagen, Trump signed on to a full-page ad in the New York Times arguing that climate change was real. This ad called upon President Obama and the Congress to pass climate change legislation. Go figure. As for Hillary Clinton, her energy policy has been described, like Obama's, as all of the above. Like him, she seems to understand the science of climate change and the catastrophes that await and indeed are already beginning to unfold, and their impact on women and children globally. But as a Secretary of State, she promoted fracking abroad and has supported offshore drilling. Interestingly, her angle on climate change, as we heard earlier, has the same emphasis as that of Donald Trump, this epic economic battle between China and the U.S. Here she is on the Charlie Rose Show.
Climate change is such a consequential crisis to everybody in the world. And it is a great shame to the entire human race, but particularly to the advanced economies such as ours, that we haven't made common cause to try to reverse or at least stabilize the temperature increase. And I'm really hoping that we get a good result out of Paris. And I think what the Chinese have done is really smart. You know, when President Obama and I crashed into their meeting in 2009 in Copenhagen.
Yes.
You know, they were not happy to see us.
Where are the Chinese? Where are the Chinese?
But they did agree to begin voluntary recording and accountability. Now they've come with, I think, a 900-page report, and they've said, look, we have a lot of work to do. Because, look, they can't breathe the air. Their water is polluted. Their land is polluted. They have said, okay, we're going to deal with this. But you know what the real trick here is? They're going to be the clean energy superpower of the 21st century.
Unless
we get there first, or unless we are partnered with
them. It takes money as well, doesn't it?
It takes money, but they're going to make big investments.
Innovation and creativity.
In solar, in wind, and everything else. And then they're going to be exporting, and they're going to be controlling that market unless we understand there's a huge economic opportunity that goes hand in hand with climate change.
Well, now that we've dispensed with presidential politics, let's get loco here on Politics is Local, a special election time program series of KHOI Community Radio. In our region, we have two races for seats on Capitol Hill, incumbent Charles Grassley versus Patty Judge for the Senate, and incumbent Steve King versus Kim Weaver for the 4th Congressional District Representative. Both incumbents, both Grassley and King, are listed on the BarackObama.com website as climate change deniers. Grassley's position is that we've got to single out what part of climate change is natural and what part is man-made before we can make policy. Steve King's take is climate change. Bring it on.
I mean, when you listen to them, James Q. Hansen and others, they're all things about global warming are bad. For them, everything about a warmer Earth is bad, and nothing is good. Now, the first thing I thought was, I spent a lot of my life cold. It felt pretty good to get warmed up. So what would happen that might be good if the Earth got warmer? Well, we'd probably raise a little more corn. I know that the temperature of this Earth, if it went up, there'd be more evaporation off that 70% of the Earth that's covered by water. And so I know by Newton's first law of physics, if it evaporates up, what goes up must come down. It's going to come down in the form of rain. So if the Earth is warmer, it'll rain more and more places. That means there'll be more plant growth. There'll be more photosynthesis. There'll be some better corn crops in places we're not raising it today. That may not be the greatest for our markets. But you see, there's something on the other side of that ledger. There's bad and there's good. And we need to look at the bad and the good and be objective about this.
On the Democratic side, Grassley's challenger, Patty Judge, says on her website that climate change is real and we need to continue to move away from fossil fuels and toward a clean energy economy. Patty Judge believes that the success of Iowa's renewable fuel and wind energy industry can be a model for the rest of the nation. She also supports investing in research to find new solutions to meet America's long-term energy demands. Kim Weaver, the challenger to Steve King, has no statement on her website about climate change. Well, now let's move from the loco to the local. As we hear Susan Franzen's interview with Irv Kloss on issues of water and climate change in our immediate environment.
I'm here with Irv Kloss, who has done a lot of work on water locally, both politically and as a citizen. Irv, what are your thoughts on this topic at this time?
Well, water is two-pronged. We have the drinking water issue, in which we find shallow wells contaminated with nitrates and pesticides. And then we have city water also, which gets its, in Ames, we get our water from shallow aquifer that's only 110 feet or so in depth. Fortunately, our floodplains and our river bottoms have deep alluvial deposits, which help filter that water as it percolates down through the glacial till into those aquifers. Our main problem is keeping those aquifers full, and during drought years, that level in the aquifer begins to go down, which affects the level of water in our wells. And so we've solved that partially by protecting the old Hallett's Quarry in the north side of town, and we're able to pump water out of that quarry, which is now Ada Hayden Heritage Park, pump the water into the river, and the Lowhead Dam that was built in the 1970s at River Valley holds enough water in the river that it recharges the aquifer. Now, the aquifer is recharged from a number of ways, and one is from a wide expanse of watershed at both the Squaw Creek and Skunk River that it replenishes that aquifer normally. And all of that is subjected to our industrial agriculture, which is surrounds us essentially and overlays the aquifers that we depend upon. And so we can't ignore the fact that that shallow aquifer could get contaminated. And if it does, I think we're in pretty big trouble, because there's no way to clean it except through time and allowing that to flush itself out. And so we've got to make sure that our aquifers are protected as well. But we also have the issue of flooding, which we're experiencing in the last few weeks here in Iowa, particularly in the eastern part of the state on the Cedar River, again. And Kamrar and Cheyenne addressed this problem today's Des Moines Register in an op-ed piece that I thought was very insightful and accurate. He cites the fact that we have done three things. We have diminished our landscapes with a type of agriculture that is very unsustainable. And secondly, we have ignored the problem of climate change, which is causing a lot of these unusual rain events that are causing these floods. And in our local governments, city and counties, we have not addressed the problem of floodplain management. And Ames is a good example of this. In the year 2000, the city revised their floodplain management plan because of pressure from the Federal Emergency Management Agency, which at that time said that they had to readjust our floodway boundaries. Now, a floodway is an area that is designated by what is still a 100-year floodplain maximum. That means that you take the average of all the floods in the past 100 years and you figure out by modeling what that boundary of that floodway is that would essentially protect any property in a 100-year flood. Well, we need a 500-year floodplain, a 500-year floodway, in which we would guard against these large rain events such as we have had in Ames and now are having on the Cedar River. And in year 2000, when that was done, I approached the city at that time and asked them to establish a 500-year floodplain. And they would not do it because there were too many commercial properties in that floodplain, particularly along Duff Avenue, that objected to any change in the boundaries, except to meet the federal requirement, which was not really a very big deal because it turned out that the elevational data that was used to establish the earlier floodway was in error. And when they corrected the elevational error they found out it was about the same as if they would establish that what was that time a current 100-year floodplain. Well, in that period since 2000, we've had the flood of 2006, the flood of 2008, the flood of 2010, and so the 100-year average is changing. But it's too late now because we've got so much more building has occurred in that floodway, or a floodplain, call it the floodplain fringe, which is kind of a joke because it's really still floodplain. And so I predict that sooner or later we're going to get another rain event in the Squaw Creek and Skunk River watersheds that will flood all the properties on South Duff Avenue. And you don't like to hear that news because we've been living on borrowed time, and we've invested huge amounts of money in the property down there on that floodplain, and now we're stuck with it. So what's the long-term solution? We've got to think on the long-term solution. And Kamrar and Cheyenne, who's a professor at the University of Northern Iowa and a friend of mine, has spelled this out very clearly. First of all, we've got to change the way we farm. He points out that if we just put 10% of the land in prairie strips as it's called, we could reduce the amount of flooding by 60%. That's a lot. And probably would alleviate a lot of the flooding on in Ames and a lot of other small towns. But more importantly, I think we need to go to the U.S. Department of Agriculture's new program that was came about 3 years ago and now is gaining some momentum, and that is a move towards soil health. And soil health means that you restore the microfauna that's in the soil, and you can do that through two ways. One is no-till, and the other is cover crops. And by doing that, you restore the health of that soil and restore carbon, which now, with industrial agriculture, we're essentially volatilizing the carbon that's in the soil and throwing it into the atmosphere as carbon dioxide, which is contributing to the climate change effect. So if we reverse that trend and put carbon back into the soil, using the sun's power to grow vegetation and incorporating that back into the soil, we can sequester or save a huge amount of carbon. It's been estimated that globally this could amount to 30% of the CO2 that's in the atmosphere could be sequestered in the soil through soil health. Now, carbon, that is, incorporated into organic matter in the soil. And when you do that, the organic matter can hold moisture. It can actually hold much more moisture than what we're doing now with the kind of agriculture that's being practiced. And if we could increase the amount of organic matter in our watersheds, say from 2%, to 4 or 6% even, we could probably hold a lot more moisture, which would benefit the farmer during drought periods and also would reduce the flooding effect during wet times. So that's one area that could be done. We should incentivize those practices such as no-till, cover crops, prairie strips, wetlands, and more of the kinds of things such as 3 and 4 crop rotation would also help. So we get more perennials onto this land. In fact, I just returned from a meeting at the Land Institute in Salina, Kansas, in which they've been working for now 40 years. This was their 40th anniversary, but they're in the 40th year of trying to completely flip industrial agriculture over towards what's known as a perennial polyculture. That is, breeding new kinds of crops that would essentially be able to be raised on a perennial stasis. That means that the land would not need to be tilled. We would simply manage for a polyculture, that is a multiple biodiverse plant base that would provide food instead of this monoculture annual plant type of agriculture that we're presently having to deal with. So changing the landscape and changing agriculture and to get away from this industrial economy to a more ecological economy, a natural economy, as Wendell Berry calls, is what we need to get back to, or towards. It's not back to. Actually, this is new, and would actually go forward. The second thing we need to do is to think about climate change and start instituting more renewable energy sources, such as wind and solar, and also conservation. We could reduce the amount of fossil fuel use that we use. This is not going to be easy, and people are going to have to sacrifice. Things are not going to be the same. We're going to have to do with less energy costly consumer that we have become. And the third thing is a good floodplain management, which we here in Ames is going to be even more costly and more difficult because we didn't do the planning that was necessary back in 2000. So that, I think that really sums it up. We've got all of this is science-based. We've got good science telling us that these things can be done and should be done, but we can't delay. We've got to get on it quickly. It's not something that can be put off till our children have to deal with it. It's something that needs to be done right now.
And that was Irv Kloss, longtime Ames resident environmentalist, speaking to Susan Franzen. We'll provide a link to that letter that he discusses by Kamyar Encheyane, a professor at University of Northern Iowa. This is Politics is Local on KHOI Community Radio. Chet Atkins and his fabulous percussionist. And this is Politics is Local on KHOI Community Radio, a special series we are producing and airing on Thursdays leading up to the November 8th election date to help keep you informed. In upcoming weeks, we will be broadcasting debates hosted by the League of Women Voters. And before I forget, today is Music Walk, and KHOI has the great pleasure of hosting Red's Blues Band, led by longtime Ames guitar hero Larry Stoltenberg, who will bring with him an assemblage of talented musicians, including his fabulous percussionist, Jordan Veach. Please come down to the station starting at 5:30 for ice cream sandwiches and good old-fashioned acoustic blues. Well, the phrase, all politics is local, is a popular saying, most often associated with the former House Speaker Thomas P. or Tip O'Neill of Massachusetts, who used the saying in his first election campaign in 1935. That was a long time ago. In the 60s, we heard that the personal is political. And no one knows that better than Mark Edwards, a Boone resident who has been involved in several issues regarding water quality since retiring from the Iowa DNR a couple years ago. Who knew that pulling a glass of water from your tap could become a political act? Yet in Boone, as in Des Moines, it is. Here's Mark Edwards of Boone telling Susan Franzen how he found himself getting involved as an advocate for water.
I retired from the Department of Natural Resources after 30 years there, and I was the planning coordination and worked on the trails program, and which led to all working with the Corps of Engineers, Historic Preservation Office, Tribal Council, DOT. I had various projects that I worked on through my career, and one was establishing the Des Moines River Greenbelt, the Neil Smith Greenbelt from Lake Sailorville up supposedly to Fort Dodge, and trying to restrict development there and make that really a recreational place to go destination. And so that led also to establishing like water trails under the DNR with paddle groups and county conservations and establishing those just like bike trails, which I also worked on in grant committees, giving money through the REAP program, awarding money to counties to develop these kinds of projects. So water became a real important issue to me because I thought, as Aldo Leopold would say, you know, you got to get people out there and into it and to enjoy it, and then they take care of it and love it and want to protect it. And so that was kind of the process. We thought we need to get people outdoors on those water trails because in Iowa, you know, we're one of the most developed states in North America. You know, the water courses are essentially the only thing left in Iowa that aren't developed. And so those are our real gems, and we wanted people to feel that wildness out there. And so then that led to water quality. And then I have lived along that Des Moines River for, oh, gosh, I can go there. Let's say I started playing in the river in 1965. So I've been living along that river for a long, long time, and I really tied to that place and really feel very strongly about it. And so that has led, once my retirement came about, I moved more into my local level and trying to protect and take care of and enhance these areas, these green belts that are left in Iowa, which are very rare. And so all there was different, I tried different ways working locally. I worked with planning and zoning on the development of that green belt along there, looking at developing a trail from Des Moines on up to Fort Dodge and working with the Corps. And that involved making agreements with each county. So I worked with the Board of Supervisors a lot with that. And one of the first major contentions that came out locally is Iowa State University, which was burning coal and its fly ash, which is a toxic heavy metal residue left from that energy source, was being transported over east and put into limestone caves to keep it from being getting into the water. Well, then in Boone County, it was brought over. They tried a different thing, and it was declared as a fill material, and they brought it over and started dumping it down by the Des Moines River, about 100 yards from the river. And they weren't following the procedure of wetting it down, covering it, and like that. So it was a tremendous fight at that point with all the local officials to educate everyone how toxic that material was and how you don't take it and just dump it down by the river. So that was kind of my first real contentious thing over water. And then As the years have gone along, I became more involved in the CAFO, confinement animal feeding operations, and those effects on water quality, and worked with various groups over that, and that relates to the nitrate levels in our water and the Maastricht matrix and how we relate as a local community to these larger issues. And recreation is part of that. So, you know, when I look at how the local level works, it's very hard because the local people see themselves as part of something much, much bigger. So when we look at water quality, it's not like we control the watershed just in our county. The water comes from, you know, above our county and comes into our county. So who takes responsibility for what? How do we determine what the ramifications, the impacts of these things are on our water quality? Well, Boone's in a very unique situation. It's we get our water, drinking water, directly out of the Des Moines River. We have shallow wells down in the river valley. And so that water that comes out of there also supplies Xenia Rural Water System, which is most of all the northern part of Story County, goes down some into Dallas and stuff. So, you know, when we had the nitrate levels continue to rise, and so it was last year, our nitrate levels went over the federal limit. And when that was triggered, it took a long time for us to figure out what that meant and who was responsible and how do we deal with that. And that was the biggest water quality eye-opening experience with me on the local level, trying to work with, say, the Board of Supervisors and the water testing and the DNR, because that put me back. The DNR requires that information that the county takes on their water quality sent to Des Moines, and then they compile that in the yearly analysis of your drinking water. So once the levels went over, I became very interested because I had a friend call me and say that he had went in, he'd heard the levels were in, and he went and he had children, and he went to the city and said, you know, I'd like to know, have more information. And he was told that because he didn't live within the city limits, it wasn't his business, and he needed to go talk to Xenia Water, Rural Water. So he contacts Rural Water and says, I want to know what's going on with the nitrate levels. And they say, well, we get our water from the city. So he gets sent back to the city. And this is the kind of thing where it became clear that we didn't really have some way of dealing with this. And the information that was coming out was not getting to the public. So when those nitrate levels become high, you know, you would go to a restaurant and there was nothing on the window warning pregnant women and children that they really shouldn't be drinking that water. So the public wasn't even quite aware of what was going on till you have a controversy. And that's where I get concerned, because local control is very important to us as a nation, because that's where things hit us on the ground. They hit us in the face, sometimes on a national level and the state level. You get into all the politics and stuff. But when I'm sitting in Boone and I can't get a drink of water that is too high in nitrates under the Clean Water Act, I grow concerned. And I grow concerned when that isn't the public discussion. And it almost seems as if we don't want to have the discussion, let alone not getting that information out to the public so they're aware of what's going on. So we get back to Boone, and as those nitrate levels continue to stay high and they continue to be right on the limit, and we get out of going over the limit by diluting it down with other well water. So the solution to pollution is dilution. And that's how we maintaining just below the limit. But we know each year that these nitrate levels are continuing to rise steadily, more often, things like that. So we're going to have to face it. We know we're going to have to face this. So I went to the former city manager and I said, you know this is coming. You got to deal with it. And the response given to me was, well, there's no way we could ever afford to take the nitrates out of the water as the city of Des Moines does. We could never afford to build a plant like that. Our water customers could never afford that. And so that really shocked me. That really said, oh, my gosh, you know, how do we deal with this then on a local level? If we can't even protect our own water, what do we do next? And that's the question I've been left with and trying to work on. So the next level that kind of came along and hit me in the face was this the Bakken pipeline, the DAPL, Dakota Access Pipeline. And it's coming right through Bone County, and it's going to cross the Des Moines River. And as I kind of got pulled into that, I realized that, well, you know, what happens if there's a spill? Because there's been numerous spills. We know that pipelines leak. It's just a matter of how long, how old they get, or how big the leak is. So I got to looking at the research, and about, they're saying, roughly 1 million gallons of toxic oil comes through that pipe per hour. So if we have a minor leak and that water hits that river in any way through the tile system or directly in the river, which they're drilling under right now, that means Boone's not going to have water, and Boone's not going to have water for a long time because it's really extremely difficult to ever get the oil out of the water. And then that oily water, depending on the size of the spill, could go on down to Des Moines, and Des Moines gets their drinking water. And their nitrate filtration system, which is in the news all the time, is not going to take the oil out of the water either. So we've got, that hit me as a major concern. Who's taking the risk for this? So I went to my local government and I said, Board of Supervisors, you know, can we take this risk? And the Board of Supervisors passed a resolution trying to stop the pipeline from being built in Boone County. And we were so proud of that resolution and everything because it was just like, yeah, we're going to stand up for our community rights. Someone's got to be responsible for this because their Dakota Access Pipeline liability at that point was $250,000, so which would cover the expense for the engineer to go out and even look at the oil, I would think. Or how would you deal with that with $250,000 when most spills are running easily in the millions and millions of dollars? So that hit me, you know, it's like the nitrates or oil, whatever. We're so dependent on that water system that we have to look at protecting it. And that was the point going all the way back to what I was talking about the green belt. The green belt is like the buffer on the field. It's the, you know, native plants along there that catch and trap all that stuff coming off the fields into the water. And so those green belts are extremely critical, not only for that filtration of water, but for the wildlife and everything else in this state that depends on that water. And I think we've really missed the boat when we don't understand how important water is to us. And we don't understand how important it is on the local level. And who takes responsibility is now what the question is. And so local control seems very important to me. And if we go back to CAFOs and animal confinements and the nitrates that are, you know, increasing in our water all the time, you know, we have the master matrix system now. And that's the state level. So the county level can't really do anything about it. They can even be opposed to placing another CAFO right beside the river, but you can't really stop it because the state overrules. Well, that's what we learned with the pipeline, is that the county can't say to the pipeline, you know, you have to have more insurance or you have to, you know, provide some more safety or whatever we want to have or to not have it, because the state then would sue the county and stop the county from passing any regulation over the pipeline. And that said a lot to me. That kind of, you know, took the wind out of my sails. I thought if I can't rely on my county government, and with my history of understanding, you know, how the state and federal level works, I was left really saddened because I don't see how we're going to address these problems on these levels.
And that was Mark Edwards of Boone speaking to KHOI reporter Susan Franzen about issues of water quality and local control. And this is Politics is Local on KHOI Community Radio. I'm your host for today, Greta Anderson. The term local control is a loaded one. It seemed to have started out being promoted by conservatives, Republicans, especially in regard to debates on issues of morality and education. Folks wanted local control of school districts and the laws and regulations that apply to schools. And yet now many Democrats are picking up the term local control, especially in relationship to the environment and special city or county measures to address that, as we heard in Mark's interview. Well, it's interesting. The Texas Politics Project at the University of Austin did a study of this concept of local control. They asked their survey participants how they felt about local cities and counties controlling the hydraulic fracturing or fracking, about cities and counties controlling the distribution of plastic shopping bags. Some cities have banned shopping bags. About Medicaid expansion under the Affordable Care Act. Should cities and states in particular have the authority to interpret the national law in their own way? Smoking in public places. Should cities and counties have the right to regulate that in their own way? The use of mobile devices while driving, the regulation of guns, and enforcement of federal immigration laws. Should all of these things be subject to local control? And what they found was that people answered differently to different questions according to their place on the political spectrum. In other words, local control was not something that people either bought into or didn't. They concluded local control is an abstract concept, likely not to be highly conceptualized among most individuals, and therefore is really less about attitudes toward the proper locus of government power, and more about the particular issues that local governments are seeking to address. If your local government is addressing an issue with a policy you find yourself disagreeing with, then maybe you're less inclined to support local control than if they are approaching the issue with a policy that you're in favor of. In Iowa, the concept of local control has largely been used in the context of CAFOs, or animal confinements, particularly hog confinements, as Mark Edwards noted. In this case, Democrats and environmentalists come down on the side of local control, wanting local county authorities to have the right and authority to reject a hog facility or put a moratorium on further construction or expansion. Republicans, often allied with big business, see the benefits of a more lenient system with fewer discrepancies between different locales. It was in 2002, under the Tom Vilsack administration, that local control of hog confinements was taken away from counties, and a master matrix system was instituted. This unified scoring system is presumably a way for the law to be uniform across counties while allowing those most familiar with the locales to score the siting of a hog confinement on its particular local features. However, there is a strong sense that the master matrix system is too lenient. The bar is very low for hog confinements to be approved, and very, very few are rejected under this system. Story County supervisors last year responded to a survey on this topic, saying that they would like more local control over the siting of hog confinements. In the words of Supervisor Rick Sanders, quote, "I don't like that right now the Board of Supervisors are the pathway to receive all the complaints, but we have no authority to do anything about it," unquote. Supervisor Wayne Clinton has also gone on record for local control. But when confronted with an actual master matrix application in Milford Township in 2014, he was lenient in the scoring. According to Loris Olson, the Democratic candidate for supervisor who would make applicants work harder to prove the environmental safety of their site. Wayne Clinton, by the way, retired from the supervisor role and then re-entered the supervisor race as an independent when Loris Olson won the Democratic nomination. Now, the state-level Environmental Protection Commission and the state-level Iowa DNR can overturn a county's ruling on the master matrix. This, again, is where politics comes into play. The present EPC, presided over by Republican Governor Branstad appointees, has rejected no master matrix applications. That EPC includes Ames resident Brent Rastetter, who has a business that builds hog confinements. When a Democratic-controlled EPC was in place, for instance, back in 2008, when Paul Johnson was on the EPC, county-approved master matrix applications were overturned when it was clear that the local outcry against the proposed hog confinements was strong. You can be sure that these issues will arise at the League of Women Voters candidate forums coming up and broadcast here on Politics is Local on KHOI Community Radio. This upcoming Thursday, we will hear audio from tonight's forum featuring candidates for state representative, including Beth Wessel-Crichel, Sondra Trout-Smith, and Eric Cooper. And that will be held in Ames City Hall, Council Chambers. And again, like I said, will be broadcast next Thursday. Ralph Rosenberg, the director of the Iowa Environmental Council, suggests that we ask the following questions of candidates for office regarding environmental policy.
People can ask for legislators to support a 3-8 cent sales tax increase because under our Constitution, the first 3-8 cents of any sales tax increase goes to fund the Water and Land Legacy Fund, which supports clean water and a variety of recreational needs. So that's a specific proposal. The other thing people can do is ask for monitoring timelines for all water conservation programs, because one of the things we have not had for several years is any kind of timeline. We have funded certain programs, but we have not said we want to see what kind of change we have in 5 or 10 years. We'd like to see reporting on watersheds. What's the overall, has the water quality improved at a watershed level? And if it hasn't improved, why not? What recommendations are being made? So we need that kind of water quality monitoring and that kind of accountability with any kind of environmental program. And with the kind of conservation programs, is with energy conservation, we need to make sure that policies are in place to encourage energy efficiency and to encourage renewable energy. There's proposals that may discourage local controlled energy, and people should ask their candidates about that. It's an issue called distributive energy or net metering, and there's proposals that may make it harder for people to own their own solar energy or to have panels put on their own businesses or farms. We want to make sure there's policies in place so that there's no undue interference from investor-owned utilities that will keep businesses or residences or farms from putting solar panels on. It's a concept called net metering. It's in the regulatory arena now, but it'll probably be in the legislative arena. And people should be able to say, we want to have policies so that investor-owned utilities do not get in the way of locally controlled and locally owned renewable energy sources. And that whatever money is spent for long-term changes are spent wisely. Because we could just throw money around the state, and it's not wisely spent. Some of these field practices take time and take money, so public should understand that. So what they should ask for is something as simple as sustainable funding. And sustainable funding can be this 3-8 cent sales tax, or it could be some other kinds of fees which will be permanent in nature and sustainable. As the nutrient strategy, which was developed in part by Iowa State University, pointed out, you know, we're looking at hundreds of millions of dollars of needs, perhaps even as much as $1 billion in needs to transform our agriculture system into one that does not contribute to our water pollution. And we're nowhere near that. I think last year we spent about $9 million on the Water Quality Initiative. Candidates can be asked simple questions like, do you believe in climate change? And if they do, what will you do to reduce the use of fossil fuels? Do you support solar energy and wind energy, which creates jobs? And people can ask those questions because there are state and federal laws which are incentives for putting in solar and wind. You know, we work on those kinds of policies.
Again, that was Ralph Rosenberg, director of the Iowa Environmental Council, speaking with Susan Franzen. That's all we have time for today on Politics is Local here on KHOI Community Radio. I've been your host, Greta Anderson. You can hear this show at noon and 7 p.m. It will also be posted on our website, along with a lot of links that connect you to the sources that we drew upon. Tune in next week on Thursday when we begin our broadcast series of the Ames League of Women Voters candidate forums. And also a reminder for you to come down to the station tonight, this evening, 5:30, for Music Walk and enjoy the tunes of Red's Blues Band, which will be playing here at the station, 410 Douglas Avenue. We will also be offering you some tasty and sustainably produced ice cream sandwich treats. Thanks to engineer Evan Taylor for helping me produce this show. And thank you for listening. And we'll see you again on the radio.